Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Happy Earth Day, Nancy Kane.
Happy Earth Day. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk with talking about Rachel Carson, because she's going to be included in your upcoming book. And you talk about the huge impact she had on intellectual thought at the time when her book came out, Silent Spring. And yet she was a very unassuming person. Tell us about her.
So she's a fascinating leader, because she ends up, you know, writing arguably one of the most important books of the 20th century. I was just looking through my, you know, kind of dog-eared, right, you know, kind of messy, scribbled-on copy of Silent Spring. And if you haven't read that book, I would just, you know, urge your our listeners to don't pass go, don't collect $200. Do go read this poetic and extraordinarily moving and carefully researched book that is just an just a tour de force. She's interesting because, you know, she had no, you know, had no kind of spin doctor. She had no speechwriter. She had no, you know, for G7. You know, she had no kind of, you know, big, powerful position among silverback gorillas. And she was a person who, as I said in a New York Times article I wrote about 18 months ago.
This is a great piece.
Right, preferred kind of walking along the coastline of Maine, looking at the different species, you know, bird and marine life that she encountered. She preferred that to, you know, her high heels clicking along the marbled floored corridors of power in Washington, where she did spend some time. You know, she was a retiring person, and yet, right, proving Ben Franklin's adage that the pen is mightier than the sword, she wrote this extraordinary book. It was not her first book. It was her last book, because as she was writing it, took a long time, involved extraordinary research. It's a book about, for those of us who haven't read it, it's a book about the dangers of synthetic pesticides, DDT being the most prominent and well-known of them at the time, and another one called heptachlor, but the dangers of mass spraying of DDT and heptachlor and like pesticides across America, and what it meant both for, you know, for the pests they were trying to eliminate, fire ants, termites, different kinds of fungus for plants and trees, and what it meant for the broader environment, including man, but also including lots of other species. And she wrote it battling a huge number of obstacles. She was battling metastasizing breast cancer. This is in 1960, 61, 62. The book is published in September of 62, serialized in the summer of 62 by The New Yorker, and causes literally a firestorm when it's published. The New York Times headline was Silent Spring, Noisy Summer, right, characterizing the book. President Kennedy read it, referred to it at a press conference, and set in motion the wheels of change that would result in the first Earth Day, which is in April of 1970, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the creation of EPA, all of which happened in about a five-year stretch at the end of the 1960s. I just looked up the afterword that E.O. Wilson, the well-known scientist, wrote about Silent Spring in some 45 years later, and he basically says, you know, a little bit like Lincoln saying to Harriet Beecher Stowe, you're the little woman who started this great big war. He says this woman ignited the forces that would light the fires of the environmental movement. So all of this happens in a kind of personal shoot that is extremely difficult for her, not just health-wise, but in lots of other ways.
Tell us about her family. She had a complicated family situation.
She had a very complicated family situation. She was from a struggling lower middle-class family outside Pittsburgh, gets to a place called now Chatham College, Pennsylvania College for Women, in the 1920s on a scholarship. And then as soon as she's able to earn an income, which she does, after she pursues graduate study in zoology and biology in as esteemed places as Woods Hole and Johns Hopkins, she immediately starts inheriting ne'er-do-well or sickly family members that can't support themselves. So at one point, she's supporting her parents. She's supporting her niece and nephew, the children of a sibling who has died. And eventually, at the age of 50, she will legally adopt her grandnephew, who is 5 at the time, all the while paying the bills and taking physical care of her ailing mother. So she was, you know, at the very center of the story, like so many women's stories, a caretaker who juggles the responsibilities of a writing job, then a bureaucratic job. It's very important. She is the chief editor for what becomes the Bureau of Wildlife and Fisheries, all the way through the late 30s, all the way into 1952, when a best-selling book, The Sea Around Us, frees her up from a W-2 income and lets her write full-time. But all the time she's doing that, she's battling illness, you know, sick children, sick mother, and just the responsibilities that women know so well and more men know of how do you juggle private and professional obligations and still continue to kind of follow a higher star, a blazing star in front of you. So it's an extraordinary story on many, many levels. But in the end, there is the work. There is this book that continues, right, to be read and sell tens of thousands of copies around the world, and that did ignite this extraordinary movement, and that laid the moral, practical, political, and sustainable foundation stones of the modern environmental movement. On all of those counts, she's the one who laid the stones.
Is she, by the way, if you don't want to answer this, you don't have to. Is she one of the individuals
you
who
bet.
You write about in your book on
she's
leadership
the last
that's
chapter.
On the work?
She's
great.
The last chapter.
You know, by the way, I want to make an admission. Marjorie will mock me for this. You're far too kind. Even though I read Silent Spring when I was in school, it wasn't until I read your piece that I ever thought about what the title meant.
Right.
How humiliating is that? And obviously she's talking about a time when birds and other animals are not doing what they do. Now, let's fast forward to what some would think would be a Rachel Carson of our time.
Totally.
Elizabeth Colbert, or I guess we could say Elizabeth Colbert, uh-huh. based upon the current use of pronunciation of the term with a K. Tell us about her for those who don't know. And what she's written and done.
So, you know, I don't personally know her. I've heard her speak a couple of times. But she is the environmental reporter, writer for The New Yorker. And she's been doing it for a while. And she's written a number of books. The most recent book is about climate change. And then this late winter, this really, you know, quite important book, as important as climate change. They're very similar books in some ways. And she reminds me more and more, the more I learn about this book and the last book, the more I think of Rachel Carson, but in the way that she's done her homework so carefully. She's been to the field. She's been to all these different places around the world where there are these very, very rapid fire extinctions happening of entire species, you know, bats, frogs, and others. And she has... nested much less unabashedly, much more nested and less obvious in The Sixth Extinction, this new book just published. I believe it's Henry Holt, published this winter. She has this extraordinarily important insight. Carson will arrange and structure Silent Spring completely around it. And that is that humankind is not by any large force meant to live in some kind of ongoing, transactional, and dominating relationship with nature. That man, like gorillas, like frogs, like fungus, right, which is a very, very old organism, older than frogs, and they're at least 400 million years old, that man and women are not meant to live in a purely transactional, you use it up, spit it out, and move on to the next resource, the next species, the next whatever. We are meant, as Carson says so elegantly in Silent Spring, to live by all natural laws that science, that the left side of the brain, never mind the heart and the right side of the brain, can ferret out, to live in a very integrated, balanced way in a complicated, interrelated, interdependent system of life. And she doesn't take it as far as Carson does, who says we have a moral obligation here. We have an obligation as citizens. We have an obligation as men and women concerned about the next generation. We morally are obligated not to lay waste the planet. Now, we can all recognize the simple and undeniable truth of what she says. Elizabeth Colbert doesn't go quite that far, but she wants to. When you read what she's saying, she wants to carry this that far and doesn't quite do it. Nonetheless, the book, The Sixth Extinction, which was written about in different ways in The New Yorker up to its publication, so she had a couple of very interesting runways into this book, is about the astounding rapidity with which species of all kinds are disappearing. Everything from, you know, frogs and bats, right, to the coral reefs, which are ecosystems that contain huge numbers of species, to what's happening to the polar ice caps, which we know a little bit about, but we're not really thinking about what that means, and what that means for the temperature of seas and the species within the seas. So just to give you one glaring and yet scientifically recognized valid fact, scientists expect that by the end of the 21st century, more than half of all species today will be extinct.
Ah.
That most amphibians will disappear, right, over the next two quarters of the 21st century. I mean, you start reading these things. It's like I got on NOAA this morning, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency. And here I just want to read you three or four things. And this is why some of this is happening. 2012, these are just bullet points on their website. And this is they're up for Earth Day, but they're up there anytime you want to look at them. 2012 was the 8th or 9th warmest year on record, depending on which data set you use. In 2012, summer Arctic sea ice reached a record low, 18% lower than the previous record. Sea levels reached a record high in 2012. And the world emitted the figures are so high, 9.7 pentagrams of carbon pollution in 2012, a new record. So everywhere we look, the balancing aspects of, you know, of sea temperatures, right, and climate temperatures and different ecosystems that exist, right, in separate and more related interaction with each other, all those things are being upset. At a rate, it's the pace that no one has ever seen before. Last comment. There's a really jarring sentence many jarring sentences in The Sixth Extinction that are not as poetic as Rachel Carson, one of which I want to read before our time is up because it's unforgettable. But there's a jarring sentence in which she talks about the fifth great extinction, which is now ascertained to be a period that ended the Cretaceous period about 65 million years ago. So that means nothing to us. It's so long ago. When an asteroid seems to have, you know, bashed in
right
to the planet, probably around the Yucatan Peninsula. Well, guess what? As she says, the asteroid is us.
But yeah, so let's step back for a second. So Rachel Carson changed the world in small and large ways. Elizabeth Colbert woke up Al Gore. I mean, that's essentially the extent. Yeah. Nobody is too broad a statement. Very few people are speaking about Elizabeth Colbert's work. I assume the book you were talking about earlier was Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Now it's The Sixth Extinction.
Right.
And I think your position is she is sort of the Rachel Carson of a half century later. Explain, what's your analysis of the comparative impact? One huge and world-changing, one modest would be exaggerating what reaction there has been. I mean, obviously, people who are predisposed to accept what she says are thrilled by what she says. It isn't like she's turning people's minds who were deniers or fence-sitters at all, is she?
I don't think we know yet. But I think there's no question that if we just go back to the summer of 62, and it's not hard for anyone to Google Rachel Carson and get some access to what was happening. It was so noisy. It's such a silent spring when the birds don't sing, noisy summer. There's no question that the impact has not been on the same order. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. I've been thinking about that the last few days. One is there's just a lot more noise going on right now, right? There were three television channels, right? And so when Eric Severide interviewed her after the book was published, she was very careful about her public appearances. She just marshaled her energy for places where she could have the most impact. And one of the interviews she did was a kind of precursor to 60 Minutes. So only one, everyone in America watched that, right? Because it was just, there was less media noise, less distractions, less stuff going on for all kinds of people's attention. I think that's one thing. I think there's a second thing that was very important, and that Rachel Carson makes an astounding call to citizenship. Elizabeth Colbert isn't doing that. And let me just read you what she says. And this is very early in Silent Spring, and it's true for our time. Let us not fall into a mesmerized state that makes us accept as inevitable that which is inferior or detrimental, as though having lost the will or vision to demand what is good. So she calls people as citizens, right, who still had credibility and faith in their government and in their communities. I mean, You know, she is, right, the call to all kinds of stuff, including the first Earth Day. She calls them to take up their agency and do something. You know, Colbert can try and do that. She doesn't. I think partly because we have so little sense of our own power as citizens. And she kind of is writing in that mirror. But the third thing is really important. It's as important as the first two. And that is that I think at some fundamental level, a lot of us have given up that we can do anything about the climactic, environmental, aesthetic, spiritual disaster that we are, in a sense, creating and participating in and closing off the future for every single day.
It's not just the environment. We just talked about the cost of higher ed. Marjorie always mentions that when higher ed, when the tuition is raised in Canada or in France by $1.50, there are 100,000 people out on the street. You could double the tuition in the United States, and we'd complain, we'd call talk radio shows, but that would be the extent of it.
And there's also the big climate change denier phenomenon where lots of people just don't believe this is happening.
But if you look at the polls, people say they believe. A lot of people, more people now.
Yeah, but is that an emotional belief or is that an intellectual belief?
I think it's an intellectual belief, and we're not still seeing, you know, Hurricane Sandy, right? You know, this last winter, notwithstanding all the insanity of hot sea levels and what they do to stormy weather and the damage they do to all of us, we're still not convinced yet that the disaster is here.
Well, also, the other things are here now. The bad economy is here now. The cost of college tuition is here now. And we can delude ourselves into believing we can fix this thing tomorrow or tomorrow or tomorrow.
But remember the scene in Out of Africa? So Robert Redford is dancing Meryl Streep around the dance floor. Dennis Finch Hatton, you know, courting Isaac Dennis. And he said, she's saying, my Limoges, my Kikuyu. Karen, we are not owners here. We are simply passing through. We owe it to ourselves and all the sentient beings and our kids to wake up, right?
That's why we love you,
wake
Nancy.
Wake up, Nancy. That's right.
This is why we love talking to you.
Thank you, Nancy Kane.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, great to talk to you, as always. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Charles Clemens, co-founder of Touch 106.1 FM, which was shut down, and Jared Bowen on the latest Arts Roundup. Our show's a production of WGBH. Chelsea, Will, John, and Amanda, thank you very much. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Please tune in again tomorrow.